Mr. Hosing?
Mr. Hosing, Your Honor.
Hosing.
Yep.
All right. Mr. Hosing, you may step forward. Again, this is McEwen versus Nebraska State College System. And Mr. Hosing, you may proceed.
Thank you, and I'd like to reserve a minute and a half for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, my name is Adam Hosing. I represent the appellant. I want to thank you first for the accommodations provided. I have paralyzed vocal cords. I've had that since birth, so I talk softer than normal. This is a case where a 29-year tenured professor was terminated in April of 2016 from Chatham State College. That termination began in September of 2015 after one of his students lodged a complaint with administration. That complaint alleged sex, age, and race discrimination, none of which were found to be true at the hearing in this matter. Nevertheless, in October 27th of that year, a memo was received by the appellant that outlined the allegations against him and discussed some of the concerns administration had had. That led to an October 30th meeting between the appellant, his immediate dean, Dr. James Marquette, the vice president of academic affairs, Dr. Charles Snare, and several other persons. That meeting was several hours long, and testimony at the hearing was that it was conciliatory, cordial, basically for fact-finding purposes. After that meeting, the appellant left and was told that further discussions and decisions regarding his discipline would be contacted. He would be contacted for that. On November 9th, he received a phone call instructing him to be at Dr. Snare's office on November 10th to discuss the matter with Dr. Marquette and Dr. Snare. When he arrived at Dr. Snare's office, both Dr. Snare and Dr. Marquette were present. Dr. Marquette sat very close to him, explained that a recommendation for his dismissal was forthcoming, and requested his resignation. The appellant did not provide his resignation, at which point Dr. Marquette handed the recommendation dismissal for him to him and said, consider this to be 17-3. And that's the first issue I want to discuss, is paragraph 17-3 of the collective bargaining agreement between the parties. 17.3 provides as follows. Before a recommendation for dismissal or notice of a recommendation for dismissal is to be provided, the dean, which is Dr. Marquette, shall meet privately with the faculty member. The district court in this case adopted a reading of the word privately to mean closed to the public or off the record.
So, Mr. Hosing, are you proposing that the language is ambiguous?
I don't believe the language is ambiguous, Your Honor. We believe it is unambiguous. It means one-on-one, the dean and the faculty member only. You can propose two different opposite meanings. It doesn't necessarily mean it's an ambiguous language. They both, it's an objective look and one reasonable meaning. Although the other party may propose another meaning, can still make the meaning unambiguous. We would propose it means one-on-one or private. Webster's Dictionary defines it as between the parties mentioned, as belonging to those parties, as secluded to other parties. We would propose the plain and unambiguous meaning of privately means that the dean shall meet privately with the faculty member. Plus, even though it is unambiguous, you're allowed to look at the other entirety of Article 17 to make sure it is in accordance with that. When you look at Article 17, particularly Section 17.4 and 17.5, they set forth the procedure where the Vice President of Academic Affairs prepares a notice of dismissal or a recommendation for dismissal, presents it to the President of Chatham State College. The President then notices that recommendation. Nowhere else in Article 17 is the dean mentioned or involved. So to say that the dean should not meet one-on-one with the faculty member would make 17.3 rather meaningless.
So if we adopted your interpretation of it, what's the purpose of that meeting that can't be met if Dr. Snare is in there as well?
There's a couple of things. So under, and I'll answer your question by what if we adopted the appellee's meaning? tonight's meeting is intended to be the last stopgap to have a conciliatory settlement, if possible. If any of those people, including Dr. Snyder, are involved, I fail to see how that could reach the import or intent.
Did your client ask for Mr. Snyder to leave?
He did not, Your Honor. I don't believe that's on his burden to ask for a right under 17.
But could he have?
Technically, he could have. That's right.
Did your client understand that this meeting, prior to the end of the meeting, did he understand that this was the 17.3 meeting?
He did not. I think there's testimony in the hearing record that suggests he did not believe that met the definition of 17.3. He had discussed the matter with his union representative. His union representative did not believe it met 17.3. He did not believe that occurred until Dr. Marquette's handed him the recommendation of dismissal and said, consider this 17.3. At least the second issue is, assuming we don't have compliance with 17.3, what does that mean? On a petition in error, this court has the obligation to review the decision for several different areas. One, it was in the agency's jurisdiction. Two, is it with sufficient relevant evidence the decision was made? Three, was it arbitrary, capricious? Four, was it in accordance with law? There are three cases that hold not following 17.3 was an arbitrary and capricious action. First is Armstrong versus Clarkson College. That's a 2017 case from the Supreme Court. That case holds that the failure to follow a mandatory grievance procedure specifically set forth in a collective bargaining agreement vitiates the ability of a party to exercise rights under that collective bargaining agreement, whether that's the employee or the employer. So not following that, not only is it void and unlawful, if it's void and unlawful, it's obviously also arbitrary and capricious. Second is Blakely versus Lancaster County. That's a 2012 case, also from the Supreme Court. That case likewise holds as a precision and error. Failure to follow provisions of a collective bargaining agreement will void and make unlawful the agency decision below, which can be reversed by a higher court. And third is an older case, Brady versus Board of Trustees. I think that is late 70s, 79, if I'm not correct. That case holds that the termination of a professor from Wayne State College after failing to follow the grievance procedures set forth in a collective bargaining agreement will vacate that termination and reinstate the professor to the previous position.
Do any of those cases talk about strict compliance versus substantial compliance?
They do not, and I would argue that Armstrong versus Clarkson College was very clear. Whether it's strict or substantial, they didn't get into that. The holding was very clear. Failure to follow the provisions of a collective bargaining agreement will void any ability to exercise rights under that collective bargaining
agreement. So there's no doubt that there was a meeting that would have been considered private had it just been the two of them. But
that's our position.
That. And your position is because there was a third person, and he didn't participate, correct?
I don't believe so.
Okay, and so because there was a third person present, that kind of wipes out that meeting happened in compliance with the collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct. It was a perceived grievance procedure provided for in the collective bargaining agreement. It was not followed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Hazing. You. Mr. Martin.
Good afternoon. George Martin on behalf of the Nebraska State Colleges, Chatham State College. We're dealing here with a collective bargaining agreement, which is a document that an employer and an employee's representative group entered into to try to create a procedure that would allow the departure of tenured faculty to proceed as smoothly and reasonably as fairly as possible. And the term that we're talking about here, the 17.3, it's pretty clear when you read it in the context of what the parties were trying to achieve here, that they wanted to have some, what I would say is akin to pre-litigation mediation. They wanted to force the parties to come together and have a conversation about whether or not they could resolve their differences and either maintain the tenured professor's tenure or employment, or come to an agreement about the way that person would depart. And so here, that's exactly what happened. And it's important to note that Dr. McKeown testified that the advice he received from the union is to not speak and just take the letter, right? So they knew going into this meeting what was going to occur. And certainly after the letter was handed to him and he was told it was the 17.3 meeting, that reaffirmed what the union had prepared him for on the front end. So the purpose of this provision of the CBA really doesn't have anything to do with ensuring that he's heard. It doesn't have anything to do with Dr. McKeown responding to allegations. It doesn't have anything to do with Dr. McKeown, a third party listening in to what he's saying, much like happened at the hearing or the advisory committee hearing where his peers heard out what happened. This is simply about, can we come together? And so when you read it in the context of 17.3, I think there's two things that are important. Or when you read it in the context of the broader process, the second sentence, which says the parties may come to an agreement, which means this is entirely passive and designed to simply foster a conversation. And then secondly, it's clear that as you go forward from that, public things start to happen. A letter is issued and it goes to the president, it goes to the personnel file, it goes to the union representative, a hearing is convened. The difference between public and private here is simply that the private is off the books, it's off the record. It allows the parties to get together without the scrutiny of the union or peers or others on campus and try to reach a decision. Now, if you were to find that was ambiguous, then the entire history of the dealings between this union and this employer suggests that the meaning that the college ascribes is the right one, because this is the way they've always done it. As a prudent business person, as a prudent employer, they've always sent someone into these meetings to observe. And that's what they did here. And they did here, I'll remind you, after Dr. McKeown had made some provocative comments to the HR director about what might transpire at this meeting, and it would be unreasonable to conclude that a prudent employer wouldn't send a witness into a meeting like this, particularly under the circumstances of this case. But if you were to find it was an ambiguous term, the entire history of the dealings between these two parties suggests that it wasn't, that the meaning ascribed by the college was the proper one. And then finally, as to the case law cited, as we pointed out in our brief, you know, this is not a regulation or an ordinance. This is not something that changed the outcome, as those cases that were cited suggest. We looked at the Bush case and said, even if you could say the collective bargaining agreement rule here is similar to a regulation passed under color of state statute, as was the case in Bush, the shortcomings there didn't result in a change in the outcome. And that's what we have here. And as a matter of fact, and I think the most important piece of fact that I can cite is Dr. McKeown admits that had that witness not been present, nothing would have been different coming out of this meeting because of the instruction he received from the union before he went to the meeting. We had a three-day hearing with, 20 or so live witnesses and 30 or 40 affidavit witnesses. We had hundreds of pages of documentation. It resulted in a finding from Dr. McKeown's peers, a unanimous finding not only that there was just cause to discharge, but also that the college should do so. And that is far and away separate from this issue under 17.3. So we believe the reading of private in the context of the entire process is clear. It means off the record. Even if that was ambiguous, the entire dealing of the parties here suggests that the college's definition is the right one, and there is no case law to suggest that even if something were amiss here as to that meeting, it would be a basis to reverse the district court's decision.
That kind of sounds like there's no prejudice resulting from having, but how does that square with the three cases that were cited by the appellant on compliance with the handbook?
Well, I think it's distinguishable on the facts. I mean, those cases, the things that were done were all, the things that were not done in compliance with the CBA were all outcome determinative. So in the case involving the Natural Resources District, they didn't collect the very information they were supposed to rely on to make that decision. In the Lincoln case, they didn't post the job and leave it open to see if anyone else would post for it before they transferred the person. And these are substantive things that it's very clear to see how those could have affected the outcome. Here, it's let's have some folks get together and maybe they'll come to an agreement or maybe they won't, and then we will begin a very rigorous and robust due process. So I haven't said no fault or no harm or no prejudice, but the fact of the matter is, especially given the appellant's testimony, that this wouldn't have mattered. The outcome would have been any different if the witness had been there or not. Certainly he can't argue that there was prejudice.
How many people can you have in the room and it still be a meeting privately?
I think that's a good question, and I thought about that. I mean, what we're talking about here is an interaction between an employer and an employee, and in the private sector, and I think it applies here as well, you know, you can have five or six or seven managers or supervisors cloaked in authority from the employer to make decisions, and that's a meeting with the employer, you know, and I think privately here we're talking about a meeting between employer and employee, and so if you have two or three or four employer representatives there, that's still a private meeting between that employer and that employee.
But isn't the spirit of it to create an environment where the employer and the employee can talk openly to try to resolve the issue, and the more employer people you have, it becomes a little bit more difficult, I think, right?
I agree 100%, and I think it's important to note that the history here has been a witness, not a participant. And so in this particular case, just like in all previous cases, sure, there's more than one, and maybe you could have two or three. Not a good idea, but the meeting is between those two. The witnesses are there for other reasons that we've already articulated. And I agree, the more folks there, the less likely to strike a deal, but there's no deal to be struck when the union says, take your letter and don't say a word.
All right, thank you.
Thank you,
Martin. And how much time do we have left for Mr. Hazen?
1 minute and 15 seconds, Your Honor.
All right. Hazen?
Thank you. A couple comments. I don't believe a deal was ever attempted to be struck. The appellant walked into the meeting, said we would like your resignation. He said no. I said, well, you're fired. That's not attempting to strike a deal. Regarding the comments on the purpose of 17.3, the language is unambiguous. The general purpose of 17.3 doesn't matter. There's also nothing in the record, contrary to what's suggested by the appellee, that creates a robust historical look of what Shattered State College or the Board of Trustees have done regarding the 17.3 meeting.
And that we only get to if we find it ambiguous, though, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record regarding that. I'll note in Armstrong versus Clarkson College, that was a holding that said the employee did not follow the grievance procedure. There was absolutely no requirement of a showing that the grievance procedure would have been successful. Likewise, in Brady versus Lancaster County, there was no requirement to show that that particular plaintiff or petitioner or complainant would have gotten that open position. In fact, there's quite a lengthy discussion in that case regarding mootness because that employer had been previously laid off in a reduction in force. So regarding that discussion, there's simply no harm or damage requirement in this area of case law.
One quick question for you, Mr. Hazing. Does 17.3 require the employer try to resolve the case without dismissal?
No, I don't think they have to go to great lengths to try to settle or resolve it, but I do think the faculty member has a right to sit with his or her immediate supervisor and discuss the matter, and if they can't agree, so be it. But if a partial decision maker, the one who's writing the recommendation for dismissal, is sitting in that room, staring at both parties, I fail to see how that can be successful towards the intent of 17.3.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hazy. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. The case will be taken under submission, and the parties are excused.